Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, last week marked the fourth anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. We'll revisit what it means for American democracy today. Then, scientists are finding remarkable similarities between humans and other animals. What might these similarities teach us, both about the human condition and our relationship to the other species? Last week marked the fourth anniversary of the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, in which the courts permitted unlimited political spending by corporations and labor unions. The decision has led to an explosion of campaign spending, more than $1 billion in 2012. The court will soon be ruling on another case, McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, which could further weaken campaign spending laws. So how did we get here, and what does it mean for politics and policymaking? We're joined by three experts. Henry Brady is Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He is author of numerous publications, including Voice in Equality, Civic Voluntarism in American Politics, and Letting the People Decide. We also have with us Professor Scott Bowman. Scott Bowman is the Chair of Political Science at the California State University in Los Angeles. Among his publications is The Modern Corporation in American Political Thought, Law, Power, and Ideas. Professor Daniel Greenwood also joins us. He's a professor of law at Hofstra Law School and the author of numerous publications that explore the intersection of corporation, speech, and constitutional law. Thank you all so much for being with us. Dean Brady, the numbers are pretty outstanding in terms of campaign spending, increased spending. Can we tell what the impact is yet of Citizens United on the political system, on campaigns, and can we tell on lawmaking?
Well, we can certainly tell that super PACs have become more important in the political process, and super PACs are almost entirely a creature of Citizens United. We also know that, in fact, there was a lot more spending in 2010 than in 2006, and that HIT spending increased enormously between 2006 and 2010, maybe from $70 million to $300 million from outside groups that are sort of covered by the Citizens United decision. So there's no question but that there's been a lot more spending. Now, whether that has had an impact in the long run on law or even on campaigns is not clear. Certainly, there seems to be a lot of sense that what's going on in the Republican nomination process is greatly affected by the super PACs, which seem to be saying things more or less coordinated, even though they're legally supposed to not coordinate such things, with the campaigns themselves.
They don't necessarily have to disclose sources of money when they're independent expenditures. So how would one know if they're coordinated?
Well, that's part of the problem, and it's really sort of making almost a mockery of the process.
Do we have a sense of how legislation is impacted through the campaign spending system? Has that been measured?
It's a really hard thing to get a handle on, because the trouble is that you can find that a certain group that later has legislation that's favorable to it has spent a lot of money for a particular candidate, but you don't know whether they supported that candidate simply because from the get-go they thought that candidate would do what they thought that candidate would do, and you don't even know whether they had an impact on whether that candidate got elected or not. So it's a very hard thing to track. There's no question, though, it has the appearance of having an impact, and that's part of what the folks who put together McCain-Feingold thought was one of the issues that should, in fact, make that a good idea to try to control campaign spending.
Scott Bowman.
Yeah, it is difficult to actually determine the impact of spending. In fact, there's been a lot of studies tried to measure that over the years. But I agree with Dean Brady that part of the issue here is also, it's not just trying to determine the impact, but it's also the appearance. And that has a great deal to do with the electoral process as a whole and its perceived legitimacy. And going back to the early campaign, or actually the Federal Election Campaign Act itself and the early interpretations of that act, the court made it very clear that it wasn't just about the quid pro quo corruption, but it was the appearance of that corruption as well that justified restrictions on campaign spending. So that's a longstanding concern, and I don't think we should just be concerned with whether, in fact, we can nail it down that someone was actually influenced in their vote. I think the broader issue has to do with the entire process. And on that note, pursuant to your email to me, or asked if I'd read Lawrence Lessig's book, I went online and found that he has a lecture. So I listened to his lecture, and he, of course, proposes some seemingly radical reforms for the entire system to introduce a form of public spending and get rid of virtually all contributions that come from corporations and other entities. And a major part of that argument has to do with the fact that some 75% of Americans have lost faith in the system in terms of the way we fund campaigns. So I would say that's a major issue that has to be addressed as well.
I want to get into Lawrence Lessig's assessment in just a bit, but I think the third issue that the courts have brought up back when they were debating the Federal Election Campaign Act in the 70s was the issue of political equality and who can actually represent constituencies in contrast to those that are supported by very moneyed people or corporations. Professor Daniel Greenwood, let's bring you in.
I want to say first about the issue of influence and the difficulty of measuring influence. Part of the reason why it's very hard to measure influence is that in the Citizens United regime, and even in the regime that preceded it, it's possible to influence elections even without spending the money. Basically, all a person with a large pot of money, a corporation with a large pot of money, has to do is to threaten to intervene in order to affect or potentially affect legislators' votes. And I think this is part of why the possibility of money, as much as the reality of huge quantities of money, leads ordinary citizens to think that the system is not functioning. On the larger issue, the principle is quite simple. This is supposed to be a democracy, a government that is run by the citizens for the citizens. And corporations are not citizens. And even rich people who can, individual people who may be citizens, but can use their money to buy influence that is completely disproportionate to the influence they otherwise would have, threaten the very basis of the republic. So American law has been very clear since essentially the beginning of major business corporations at the beginning of the 20th century that corporations are not permitted to intervene in elections. We have allowed them to lobby to some degree, but there have often been restrictions on it. And the Supreme Court in Citizens United and has taken another large step in the direction it's been going since the 1970s, off and on, in essentially destroying the underpinnings of the electoral system. It's also a disaster from a corporate law perspective. It's quite shocking to find that corporate managers are entitled to spend money that is not their own, and the states that create the powers of the corporate managers apparently are limited by the First Amendment or by the Supreme Court's interpretation of the First Amendment from deciding how managers will use the authority that is entrusted to them.
One quick note, Professor Greenwood, about the intervention. When I worked for the California legislature, I actually witnessed this when legislators would attempt to take action in something that went against a very powerful group. There was definitely the threat of removal, and it clipped the wings of many legislators, I think.
Look, the point is this, right? Electoral politics, as expensive as it is quite cheap by comparison with the sort of consumer advertising that corporations ordinarily do. All a corporation has to do is to recognize that if advertising works, it should be able to affect not only the votes of the legislators, but the votes of the electorate. Advertising, they believe advertising works. They're willing to use it. And they don't have to divert very much of their ordinary advertising budget in order to create a lot more profits than they would by selling products, by instead changing laws. This threatens the system by which we keep markets working for us instead of making them simply opportunities for wealthy institutions to buy legal rights that the rest of us don't have that enable them to get even more wealthy so that they can buy even more power.
Scott Bowman, let's bring you back in because Professor Greenwood mentioned the historic precedents of corporations not being able to be engaged in the campaign process legally. How did we get here?
Well, we got here through a series of Supreme Court decisions. People were shocked by Citizens United, but actually several things preceded that. As long ago as 1978 in the Bilotti case, the court didn't formally extend First Amendment rights to the business corporation, but it sort of did it in a roundabout way in striking down a restriction on corporate expenditures in a referendum. But the court maintained after that expenditures in candidate elections were unconstitutional, and there's a federal statute that prohibits those, and that's basically the statute that was struck down in Citizens United. In the Austin case in 1990, the court upheld a similar limitation to the federal statute in Michigan. And at that point, the court put forth a novel theory. It's actually a theory it had sort of worked on in the previous case, concerning the effects of corporate speech, they had to keep it in line in terms of precedent with the earlier argument in Bilotti that the reason you can limit contributions or expenditures for that matter is that it's somehow related to either a quid pro quo corruption or the appearance thereof. So what the court did is they extended that rationale, and they argued that the expenditure of large sums of money amassed through the corporate form constituted a type of corruption that distorted the marketplace of ideas. That became the new standard. And that was debated heavily at the time. And interestingly, Chief Justice Rehnquist was on the side of the majority. It was when Rehnquist left the court, Roberts came in, that everything began to change. So that was really the turning point. And then we see in some case law, in Wisconsin Right to Life case, a movement towards loosening restrictions that had been upheld under McCain-Feingold legislation, and then that just sort of paved the way for this decision. It was a 5-4 decision in Austin. Interestingly, Rehnquist was a critical vote. When he's replaced by Roberts, the court, many members of the court, were prepared to do this for years. Scalia, Thomas had argued that it should have been overturned, Kennedy as well. So it doesn't surprise court watchers that it actually happened, but it seemingly came as a shock to the American public. Now, the other thing I would like to mention, the corporation had rights under the 14th Amendment going back to 1886. At least it was recognized as a person for purposes of property rights at that point. So it's had certain rights given to it since then. The idea, though, of giving it rights of speech is extraordinary, and you have to maintain that the corporation is a person in some sense beyond the legal fiction. The legal fiction argument is there, give them standing in court so they can sue and be sued with regard to property rights. So this is a very different matter. Frankly, I still can't quite figure out the court's reasoning. I've read these cases, I've written about it, but there's some kind of strange intellectual process that goes on when they argue that a corporation is similar to a person who has rights in the marketplace of ideas.
So the effect of this system, according to Lawrence Lessig, since you brought him up, he calls it the economy of influence, and that it discriminates rather than on one side or the other, but really against all sides to favor itself. So he's saying essentially that those who are most connected continue to keep themselves in power. The rich get richer not from innovation, but from manipulating the process. If we can bring Dean Brady back in, you've looked at issues of equality, perhaps not in the same framework that we're talking about, but how do you see this all coming across in terms of political equality?
Well, it's certainly a blow to political equality. Just to give you one quick statistic here, the Sunlight Foundation found out that in the 2010 elections, 27,000 donors, that's not the top 1%, that's the top 1% of the top 1% in the nation, gave about a quarter of all the money from individuals that went to candidates, PACs, political parties, and independent expenditure groups in 2010. So that means that a very small group of people are giving the bulk of the money. And presumably those folks get a chance to interact with the candidates, and I've been to some of these events where candidates meet with prospective donors, and there's nice conversations, and it's wonderful to get to meet the candidates, but I certainly know that the person who's giving $5 or $10 or nothing certainly never gets a chance to have these kinds of interactions. And so it's those kinds of things that makes you worry. Do the folks who are running as candidates not know the ordinary American? Do they have the kind of problem that we've seen Mitt Romney have in trying to describe his income situation, where you get the sense that he just doesn't quite understand what most Americans have to deal with, and perhaps that's because he hasn't had much interaction with the folks making $10,000 a year or $20,000 a year or $30,000 a year, because those people don't give the money that really fuels politics right now.
So it affects the electability, who is represented, who is representing. Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're looking back at the decision, Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, how we got here and what it means for American democracy. The other thing that doesn't get mentioned all the time that I think is important is that the dialing for dollars phenomenon really eats up a lot of legislators' time, leaving very little time for actual analysis of policy.
Yeah, and that's right. And they're not dialing again. the person on the street. They're dialing people who have lots of money, who in those phone calls then say, you know, I'm really worried about X issue or Y issue. And we know that people who have lots of money have different concerns than people who have less money. It's as simple as you can imagine that people with lots of money are more worried about high tax rates, for example. People with less money are more worried about government services, good schools for their kids, and things like that. So that you have different kinds of issues that different groups care about, and those groups have quite different access to the political process because of the enormous role that money plays in politics.
Professor Greenwood, let's bring you back in.
Let me address that specific issue, because the dean was talking about contributions by human beings. And, of course, rich people have different interests than the middle class. But corporations have a different interest altogether. And it's really quite important to think about the difference between corporate contributions, which is the great innovation of Citizens United, as opposed to the older problem of the Supreme Court's equation of money with speech. It goes back now already a generation. The specific problem with corporations is that corporate donations are made by corporate managers who are bound by law to act in the interests of the corporation. Now, the law doesn't usually say what the interests of the corporation are, and so there's a certain amount of leeway here. But managers are directed to think about not the interests of the country and not their own interests, but the interests of the company. And the interests of the company will almost always be contrary to the interests of the economy as a whole and the interests of the country as a whole. In this sense, we need a dynamic economy in which new companies can innovate and can find new niches and create new products that create new jobs and new products, right? But incumbent companies, the existing companies, are almost always going to be threatened by innovation. And so what we're doing with Citizens United is we're creating an economic system that will use its power, and its power is huge, to change the law to create more economic power for the companies that already have economic power. You don't need to worry about an innovative product if you can simply get the legislature to pass a law saying it's illegal.
Scott Bowman.
We've seen that happen, actually, in recent years.
Or even with SOPA.
You know, with merger movement itself, especially, the wave of mergers and media conglomerates are a prime example. And what really happened there was Congress was sort of captured, I guess you'd say, by corporate lobbyists, but also by contributions. I think, you know, corporations contribute both sides, so you can't say it was just a one-sided issue. But in addition to that, the Federal Communications Commission was staffed with people who were amenable to these changes or to this interpretation of antitrust law. And just a remarkable shift in policy occurred beginning in the Reagan era and going on through, it was actually the late Carter presidency, and going right up to the present. And it was both administrations, Republicans and Democrats, who facilitated this. I think that's really solid evidence for what Professor Greenwood is arguing.
Perhaps this would be the perfect time to talk about this movement. A lot of grassroots organizations, Common Cause, Public Citizen, Move to Amend, there are several of them working, seems, in tandems. Cities are making resolutions in opposition to Citizens United. There's been an introduction of a constitutional amendment in Congress to try to overturn this. Perhaps this is something we've seen a little bit before. Dean Brady, can movements like this succeed? And if so, what does it usually take?
Well, it's possible this movement could succeed in the sense of getting past what it's proposing to pass, but the trouble is it's not clear what exactly you have to do to overturn Citizens United. The Supreme Court decision basically said that the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and said that applies to everybody, including corporations. So some people have said, well, that just means, let's say, that corporations aren't people. But it's not clear that you can define that in a way, any kind of movement to say corporations aren't people, that would in fact pass legal muster, and that would in fact ultimately solve the problem. And so maybe the better way to go is to start talking about changing corporate governance. I think the bigger issue here is the fact that right now you have corporations which only have to think about their welfare in terms of the profit they're making, but maybe you have to have corporate governance changed in some ways so that, in fact, they also think about, okay, what's the general welfare and exactly how are they using their money to try to affect the general welfare? Now, that's a big big task to try to change that, and maybe that's impossible as well. The trouble here is that almost every direction you go, it looks like it's going to be really hard to change around Citizens United, given the current complexion of the court and given the degree to which they predicated it on the First Amendment that says there'll be no law abridging freedom of speech or the press.
I just wanted to note that there's also a movement by shareholders to prohibit the corporations from spending if it is in opposition to what they want, or to at least disclose how they're spending money from the corporation.
It seems to me that might be a better way to go, to try to get corporations to at least disclose how they're spending that kind of money. And in many ways, by the way, the thing I worry most about is corporations in a state, let's say, like Montana, which are very powerful, where the Anaconda Corporation for many, many years was enormously powerful, and corporations like that doing what one wag once said that the Standard Oil did to the legislature of the state of Pennsylvania, which was Standard Oil did everything but refine it. And it seems to me that the problem is corporations in states like that could have enormous impacts upon elections, because there that might be tremendously in their benefit to try to affect who gets in office so they can get special privileges, mining privileges or laws that are favorable to them and things like that. And that's the kind of place where real problems might arise. And so it's very interesting to see that the Montana Supreme Court said that there's a law that's been passed there in 1912 that said corporations can't give money to elections, and they said they wanted to uphold that law, and in effect they're challenging Citizens United through their affirmation that the Montana law should continue to limit corporate contributions.
Scott Bowman, I want to bring you back in to give us the historic matters that you've looked at. Some of the things you wrote about in your book include the intertwining of ideology and law and power. Can you link all of this together in terms of movements and how they've resulted here, and how they compare, perhaps, to what we're dealing with?
The first thing that comes to mind is where we were 100 years ago in many respects. The center focused during the Progressive Era. The Progressive Era is generally 1895 to 1915 or so, depending on how one deals with the First World War. But during that period, progressives came together, people of different political parties, not just the Progressive Party, and the center of attention, that really what they were focusing on, was corporate power. That's what the issue of the day was. And when I'm reading the press today and reading blogs and seeing this opposition to Citizens United, and it's broadened into a general critique, really, of corporate power in American politics, but also corporate power in general, I'm reminded of the progressive movement 100 years ago. I'm not saying that we have a new progressive movement, but the issues are very similar. And, of course, now we have global capitalism, not just capitalism in the United States, that people are addressing. That's one thing that strikes me. The other thing is that the ideological justification, for lack of a better term, of corporate power has become very sophisticated in the last 100 years. And so people, particularly justices on the Supreme Court, are able to defend corporations as if they were people, as if they were just speakers in the marketplace of ideas, and argue that their ideas are just as important as everyone else's. So there's something else that's gone on in this last 100 years, and that is that we don't have that same kind of shock that the Progressive Era people did about the rise of the large corporation and its influence on politics. It's something we've lived with for quite a while, but seeing this sentiment reborn, in a sense, is very significant. So I don't know if we're going to have a broad-based movement of this sort, but there are signs of it. But what we're going to deal with now is very different. It's not an incipient corporate power. It's a well-established and institutionalized corporate power. And remedies are going to have to be very different.
I think it's very important, too, to realize that the founders dealt with a society that looked a lot different than society today, where there were not these large corporate entities with tremendous amounts of power. And therefore, to some extent, just going back to the Constitution and saying, well, that's what the founders said, let's interpret it that way, really misses what happened, as Scott says, during the 19th century with the rise of tremendously powerful corporations, and therefore makes us unequal to the task of trying to deal with the concentrated power that we now see in America.
I would say from a legal perspective, I'm not quite sure I agree with that. If there is, in fact, a political movement that wants to restrain corporate power, there's no constitutional problem. The Constitution doesn't mention corporations anywhere. And there's not even a problem that would require convincing the Supreme Court to change its interpretation. Essentially, any state that chose to define this not as a problem of speech, but as a problem of who is entitled to spend corporate money, could, if it had the political will, solve the problem within the particular state simply by saying that corporations, of course, as the Supreme Court has said, are free to spend their money, but that doesn't mean that the corporate CEO or the corporate board is free to spend money that is not its own in pursuit of its own views. The money belongs to the corporation, and the states get to decide how corporations make their decisions. And all a state would have to do to completely solve the entire problem would be to pass a law saying if a corporation wants to spend money to influence an election, it has to first take a poll of its employees and its customers to determine how they would like their money spent. And there's no possibility that any American corporation would agree to do that. They would simply opt out of the system.
And that is somewhat like what is going on with the shareholders movement.
It is to this extent that the shareholders are making an additional contention, which is that the money is theirs. That's simply not correct. They didn't provide the money. They're not entitled to the money if it's not spent on electioneering. And I don't understand any democratic rationale why we should allow shareholders, who basically are other corporations, to determine how our electioneering is done. It seems to me that that needs to go to the people, not to institutional shareholders. And the people in the cases of corporations are the employees and the customers.
I think that's a perfect place to end. Thank you all so much.
Thank you very much.
Henry Brady is Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He is author of numerous publications, including Voice Inequality, Civic Voluntarism in American Politics, and Letting the People Decide. Scott Bowman is the Chair of Political Science at the California State University in Los Angeles. Among his publications is The Modern Corporation in American Political Thought, Law, Power, and Ideology. Professor Daniel Greenwood, he's a professor of law at Hofstra Law School and the author of numerous publications that explore the intersection of corporation, speech, and constitutional law. When we come back, like humans, animals get depression, addictions, eating disorders, and engage in many related behaviors. What can we learn from animals about the human condition? Stay tuned.
I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may fade, my dog will always come through. All he asks from me is the food to give him strength. All he ever needs is love, and that he knows he'll get. So I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may fade, my dog will always come through. All the pay I need comes a-shining through his eyes. I don't need no cold water to make me realize that I love my dog as much as I love you.
This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Scientists are increasingly finding similarities between humans and other animals. Other animals cooperate, communicate, spread culture, and experience a wide spectrum of emotions, including empathy, joy, and jealousy. They are also similarly affected by disorders like addiction, depression, food disorders, and self-harm, which were once thought to be found only in humans. Just how similar are we to other animals? And what might these findings teach us about the human condition and our relationship to other species? With us is Barbara Natterson-Horowitz. She is a cardiologist, the director of imaging at the UCLA Cardiac Arrhythmia Center, and a cardiac consultant for the Los Angeles Zoo. She's co-author of Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. Mark Beckoff is professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and his books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and co-author of Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Stan Kujai is also with us. He is director of the Marine Mammal Behavior and Cognition Laboratory at the University of Southern Mississippi. He's co-author of The Emotions of Animals and Humans, Comparative Perspectives. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with Barbara Natterson-Horowitz. In your book, Zubiquity, you found remarkable similarity between animals and human health and disease. Some of the things that were most fascinating were the behavioral and mental similarities. depression, addiction, grieving, food disorders. Just how similar would you say humans and animals really are in these areas?
Well, I'm a physician, as you said, and like most physicians, my training didn't include anything comparative. And so until I started doing research for this project, I really was not aware that animals suffer from everything from breast cancer and Crohn's disease, brain tumors, congestive heart failure, that the overlap between human and animal pathology is very significant. But what was perhaps the most interesting and illuminating aspect of the research was to learn about comparative psychopathology, the overlap in mental disorders between humans and many animals. In general, the broad categories of psychiatric disturbances that we see in human beings, we also see in a variety of animal species, including anxiety disorders, compulsive disorders, as you mentioned, disorders involved with dysregulated eating behavior, even such things as self-injury, which I had, as a physician, always assumed to be uniquely human. But of course, I was wrong.
Why don't we talk about a couple of those examples, perhaps starting with self-injury?
Well, there are several characteristic forms of self-injury that we see in human patients. Probably the most iconic is cutting, which is a real paradox, because when you ask a human patient, you know, why they're doing this, they actually tell you that it causes them to feel calm. It gives them relief and release. And this is interesting, I think, to sort of turn to the animal case and look at animals who self-injure and ask veterinarians and wildlife biologists why they're doing that. And one of the hypotheses that I have is that grooming, which of course is soothing to all species, can be amplified and turn into self-injury. We see that in human patients, and I wonder whether that's the same thing that we might be seeing in animal patients.
Mark Bickoff.
Everything Barbara said, I would agree with. As an ecologist and evolutionary biologist, I'm much a fan of Charles Darwin's ideas about evolutionary continuity, which says basically the differences among animals are differences in degree rather than differences in kind. So, you know, all biomedical research and a lot of comparative behavioral research really centers on that. And the bumper sticker there would be, if we have something, they do too. In terms of the psychopathologies in non-human animals, there's a lot of work being done now on captive animals, chimpanzees, elephants, dogs, suffering from PTSD due to the horrific conditions in which they're kept. And there's also some evidence in the field. I studied coyotes for a decade years ago in the Grand Teton National Park, and I remember seeing an animal who I've written about these animals who I would have called a bipolar wolf or an autistic coyote. I think in the wild what happens, though, is often these animals just don't survive. So I like to think that, you know, it's rare, but the cases that I know of extreme psychological disorders really do come from animals in various forms of captivity.
Mark Bickoff, your work also suggests that animals, like humans, also experience things like empathy, cooperation. They have codes of morality, fairness. Where do we see these behaviors?
Well, we certainly see them in social mammals, and there's just been some really fascinating work done on fish showing cooperative hunting. There's been a recent study published of fish using their head to signal where food is. We call that referential or gestural communication, thought to be only in humans and then non-human primates and now fish. But really the best cases come from mammals, where we see joy, you know, great joy, deep grief and sorrow, resentment, embarrassment, jealousy, all these psychological states, if you will, and emotions are being, you know, studied in a whole lot of different species, and we're finding them in ample numbers.
Stan Kujai, you also have found some of these aspects in your work. How would you compare it?
Well, we're definitely interested in emotions in non-human animals, especially cetaceans, the species we study the most, but also elephants and other species. I guess I would be a little bit more cautious than Mark, because I do think that animals have emotions. I think it's very difficult to assess them. And so we certainly see things that look like grieving, and I would describe them as grieving. It's just hard to, if the grieving that we're talking about, how similar it is to human grieving, for example. Mark mentioned joy. One of our research emphasis is on animal play. I know Mark has done a tremendous amount of work on that as well. And I certainly interpret playful behavior as joyful, and I certainly think the animals find it pleasurable. At least I hope they do. But again, it's that comparison to human emotions, which I think is the scientific quandary. How similar are they to human emotions, and how different are they? As Mark noted, we believe there's a continuity involved between, among various species, But is it a fuzzy boundary? Is it a distinct boundary? Is there no boundary? And I think you could find arguments in literature for all of those positions. One of the things we're interested in dolphins is how they read the emotional states of other dolphins. We think that's really important. They're very social, and being social animals, they need to understand how other animals are feeling in order to determine how to best interact with them. And we think they're good at that, but we don't have much of an idea about how they do that. Probably has something to do with acoustics, the sounds that the other animals make. It may be that they use echolocation to get a sense for muscle tension and heart rate and things like that to read emotional state. So to me, it's a fascinating field. It's one that really hasn't been studied that long in animals. And I should acknowledge that Mark's one of the leaders in that field. So I want to thank him for helping guide us along that way. It's only recently that comparative biologists and psychologists have even dared to say words like personality and emotions when talking about animals. And I think it's made the field not just richer, but also more theoretically sound to acknowledge the fact that animals do have personalities, that they do experience emotions. And even though they're messy things to talk about, you know, I always mention to my students when we're talking about this that one of the things that I think human couples disagree about the most is how the other member is feeling.
I would take a different point of view. I mean, I agree a lot with what Stan said. I would say that we don't need to use humans as a template. I mean,
oh, I agree.
Dog joy may be different from chimpanzee joy. There's wonderful research by a neuroscientist named Jaak Panksepp who looked at laughing and tickling and joy in rats. And these papers were published in Science magazine, you know, where most of my colleagues would like to publish one paper in their lifetime. And the reason I say that is because they're not just, you know, sort of folk tales. They're not stories in Time magazine. And Jaak found that rats like to be tickled. He's done the neurobiology of it, and it's really very solid work. So from my point of view, I think it's impossible. I mean, frankly, I would say it's impossible to question whether two dogs running around playing with one another are not feeling dog joy. There's been recent work done on depression in bees. Very high-end research showing, in fact, that they show the same neural changes as do humans when we become depressed and pessimistic. So my answer would be, I don't think we need to use humans as a measuring stick. And I think that, you know, once again, it's hard to do the experiments, but a lot of field work, I mean, watching coyotes and wolves in the wild, there's so much evidence that they have what we call theories of behavior and theories of mind. And just because we may not be very good at certain things, I think one could easily argue very compellingly that there's reasons why certainly wild animals would have to be very good at these sorts of cognitive skills.
Barbara Natterson-Horowitz, we've been talking about depression. We've talked about grieving. How similar have you found the animal kingdom?
Well, this conversation is exactly what I've been thinking about. And as I'm hearing this discussion, I've been thinking, well, what are the common mechanisms? I mean, how the question is sort of, you know, are the experiences the same? That's one question. And the second question is, if they are at least similar, is that driven by highly conserved neurophysiological systems? And one of the most interesting perspectives is to look at pleasure. Why perhaps animals and non-human animals are rewarded with fitness-promoting behaviors with pleasure. So we get pleasure from eating, and animals seem to get pleasure from eating, sex, certain substances, and so on. There's a wonderful book called The Compass of Pleasure by David Linden from Johns Hopkins who writes about this. And so I think one of the ways of thinking about the commonality of experience between humans and non-human animals is to consider from an evolutionary perspective this phenomenon of pleasure.
You mentioned the neurological perspective. There's been considerable new work looking at the brain. How do these fit in?
I mean, there's lots of different ways to look at this. I think one very fascinating piece of literature from the human side is to look at the benefits to human beings when they're around animals. So just the simple act of petting a dog for a patient in the hospital or just a, you know, someone in their home, has the effect of increasing heart rate variability, which is a marker of sort of the health of the autonomic nervous system. And what's interesting is as a human pets a dog, the heart rate variability of the groomee, that would be the animal, improves, as does the HRV of the petter. And this connects, I think, to questions of mirror neurons and all kinds of really only partially explored areas.
Let's go back to Mark Bekoff. You've written about this sense of compassion. You've talked about primary versus secondary emotions. What examples can you give us about these acts of compassion or empathy, and where does that fall in terms of the level of emotion?
There's lots of, I say stories, but I mean there's data too, but you know, there are lots of good examples of animals, talking, you know, wild animals, but just recently I was just thinking of the study showed that rats will help rats who are restrained free up. There's a lab study done at the University of Chicago. The first study was done that rats would help free up a restrained rat, you know, and they did all the necessary work, I think, and they described it as being due to empathy. And they then gave the rats choice of freeing up a restrained rat or eating chocolate, and they preferred to free the rat over eating chocolate. And I'm not sure I know a lot of humans who would do that, but also work done on empathy in mice. These are lab studies. And so empathy in chickens, and these are all once again published in peer-reviewed journals. So I think that when we see a behavioral phenomenon to which we would put the label empathy, and I think what Barbara's saying is true, you know, you have to look at the neuroarchitecture, you can look a lot at the neurophysiology, but when you see the similarities there, then it just seems to me that we are seeing similar phenomena. I don't know how the rat feels directly when he or she frees another rat, but it could still be driven by the same emotion. I've seen wild elephants in Africa helping one another in situations where the elephant who is being helped would die without that aid. And when I wrote about some of these observations, you know, some people said, well, there must be some reason. The injured elephant must be able to do something for those who are helping her. But the fact of the matter is, you know, one of these cases went on for 15 years, and without being surrounded by and being fed by other elephants in a group, this elephant would be prey in a heartbeat.
You are listening to The Scholar's Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the similarities and differences between humans and other animals. Stan Kuchai, what is your research showing us about culture and cooperation among animals?
Well, dolphins are incredibly cooperative. I think that we see that in terms of foraging and protection from predators and so on with wild animals. It's been a little bit difficult to demonstrate in a laboratory-type setting with dolphins, but I suspect that's mainly because we haven't found a task which is interesting enough for them to want to cooperate on. And honestly, I mean, we know they can cooperate. It's just been hard to show it in a more controlled setting. I guess the thing that I'm more interested in is, you know, how young dolphins learn to communicate, how they learn to, for example, read other dolphins' emotions, how they learn to be members of their group. And so that's where the cultural transmission comes in. And one thing that dolphins are really good at is observational learning. And cats spend a lot of time watching other dolphins and exploring the world on their own and or with other dolphins. We have found that personality plays a big role in that. Some calves are bolder than other calves, and they typically lead the way, and they're the ones the more sophisticated forms of play and sort of challenge themselves more. And the more cautious calves follow in their, I was going to say foot paths, but let's say their
fin paths.
So one thing that's, I think, important to note, one thing we have found with dolphins, which I think we'd find in lots of species, is that not all models are equally salient. So, for example, there are some calves which lead the way, not necessarily because they're the bold calves, but oftentimes they are, at least in terms of play. And so they're the ones that provide the models for the other calves. Some calves may be engaging in certain behaviors or interacting with an object or other dolphins. One of the things that, again, that is really striking about dolphins, not to put them on a pedestal at all, but the fact that I think that they do learn a lot from one another, and we're just trying to figure out exactly how they do that and how calves do that. We have learned that sometimes, you know, male dolphins actually participate in the rearing of calves. And that's something that hasn't been seen very often. But so just assume that they had their fun and left and didn't ever do any parenting. But now we know that there are some exceptions to that rule. And given how little we actually know about dolphins and how many dolphins are out there, there may be more exceptions than we know of.
Mark Bekoff?
what Stan said at the beginning, that you know they cooperate, but it's hard to demonstrate, say, in the lab or in captive animals. That's exactly the point I was making before about animals having a theory of behavior, you know, predicting what other animals will do in a certain situation, or a theory of mind, understanding what other animals are feeling. A lot of the experiments that are done in captivity involve humans hiding food or humans doing certain things and then seeing what animals such as, you know, say chimpanzees know. And some of them come up with negative results, and then people say, well, clearly these even great apes don't have a theory of mind. I think that there may be things that are intractable in captivity. A very famous primate researcher told me once that one of the reasons he thinks people get negative results on certain sorts of studies in captivity is the animals are bored. And he wasn't being facetious. He was saying he just really thinks that they just tune out. So, you know, once again, when I've watched packs of wolves or coyotes, it seems impossible for me to explain the high degree of coordination and cooperation if they didn't say, well, Stan is likely to do a certain thing in a certain situation. Animals have these temperaments, personalities, predictable behavior patterns, or, well, you know, maybe based on what they assume he's feeling. So I'm going to keep the door open on that because I think there's still a lot of natural behavior that begs for a more reductionist explanation, because these animals have very complex social lives, and I don't think you can just jam them into predictable stimulus response type of paradigms.
You mentioned boredom, and that is something that Barbara Natterson-Horowitz has also written about. What about boredom?
One of the interesting outcomes from research about self-injury in animals, particularly in horses, and it was primarily from stallions, is that horses that begin to flank bite and do other kind of stereotypic forms of self-injury typically are felt to be bored or isolated, and it's the interventions are directed at reversing that, so creating a more enriched environment. In some instances, and this is less about boredom and more about isolation, placing another animal in close proximity to the horse, not necessarily another horse, even a little chicken, for example, seems to help. But the fact of boredom being a risk factor for self-injury, I think actually connects to the human side. If you look at human patients who do a lot of self-injury, one group of individuals are prisoners, and self-injury in prisoners is seen, the more serious forms of self-injury are actually seen in prisoners in solitary confinement. Again, a very bored population.
Stan Kujai, you've also looked at intelligence, particularly, again, in dolphins. You looked at their ability to plan.
Looking both at work that has been done in captivity and observation in the wild, it's clear that they plan. The fact they can cooperate in the wild, I think, requires planning. And the fact that they can demonstrate planning in these artificial tasks that we set up in captivity shows that they have very flexible problem-solving skills in this area. So I also like to go back to the boredom thing and relate that to intelligence and self-injury as well. I do think that the idea that lots of animals in captivity that do self-injuries are bored is spot on. And one of the things that we've noticed in dolphins is that dolphin calves typically make their play more and more complex. So they start off doing something, then they get really good at it, and then they make it more difficult, and they make it more difficult, and so on. And I think part of that is because that way the play doesn't become boring. But the other part of that is I think they're challenging themselves. And so that what they're doing is they're doing, in a playful context, something that, you know, they have some control over, they're nonetheless setting up situations in which they're sort of driving their own cognitive development. And so we think that dolphin play is actually really serious in the sense that it facilitates these flexible problem-solving skills that we see in captivity and in the wild.
Mark Beckoff?
I think he's right. I think when you watch play patterns, that the animals are challenging themselves in a safe environment, if you will. They'll try things. You know, they know they won't get punished if they overstep their bounds. I haven't studied intelligence directly, I think I have. I tend to not use the word intelligent or smart because they're loaded terms. I think of adaptation. I think of the way in which animals are so good at changing their behavior in varying situations. And one of the theories we put forth about play was that play is training for the unexpected. Because if you look at sequences of play in different animals, we study this, they're much more random than sequences, say, of what we might call serious aggression or serious predation or serious courtship and mating. And we think the flexibility comes from play, where they just string behavior patterns randomly. So some people would cast that out as intelligence, and I suppose it is, but I just like to be careful. But I'm astounded at how fast coyotes and wolves and a lot of animals, a lot of birds, can adapt to changing environmental or social conditions, just literally on the run or on the fly. So I think there's something smart going on there, if you will.
So there's two last directions I'd like to go in here. One is really, ultimately, what are we learning with this comparative study, both for the human condition, but also how we treat animals? Barbara Natterson Horowitz, you've been looking at this primarily from the human condition because you're a doctor.
Well, I mean, Stan and Mark are both accomplished animal behaviorists, and I come to this later in life from a different pathway. And I have to say that throughout my early education, college and beyond, I experienced this kind of recurring firm admonition against anthropomorphizing. To anthropomorphize was sort of an intellectual crime. It was soft. It was projection. And without really realizing it, I think it inhibited my willingness to see connections between human and non-human animals when they were there. And I think I share that with a lot of people who came up in that don't anthropomorphize tradition. On the other end of the spectrum, of course, we want to have the appropriate scientific skepticism and go through the scientific method. But that said, one of the really important takeaways for human patients who are suffering from a spectrum of psychiatric illnesses when it comes to comparative psychopathology is that they're not alone, that these conditions are not uniquely human. And by the way, many of these conditions are highly stigmatized. Psychiatric disorders like self-injury, addiction, even depression and anxiety disorder, compulsions. Patients who suffer from these, many of them never get care. They are embarrassed in certain cultures. It is highly stigmatized to have a psychiatric condition. I think simply pointing out that these conditions are not uniquely human has the potential to reduce stigma and actually improve access to care for some patients.
Mark Beckoff?
I really like that. I work in a prison. I teach there on Fridays. And everything you said is so, so true. Barbara went into the notion of anthropomorphism, and I've written many times that we should just put that aside. I don't allow my students to talk about it anymore because we're all necessarily anthropomorphic, using the language we know to just talk about other animals. We need to be careful. But a lot of the critics who say you're just being anthropomorphic are playing a double-edged sword, because I was in a situation once where I said, oh, that elephant, look at that lone elephant in a cage in a zoo. She looks really unhappy. And the guy with me said, oh, you're being anthropomorphic. She's happy. And then it got really quiet. And I got really quiet because to say another animal is happy would be anthropomorphic too. So I just wanted to make that comment. I think what we're learning now, I'm very much into what I call animal protection. I'm honest to say that I don't like the phrase animal rights because it turns people off, but I may be more of a rightist. And I find animal welfare to be a little too wishy-washy, just with the utilitarian point of view, you know, where humans decide the costs and the benefits. I do feel, though, what we're learning now can all be used on the animal's behalf. We learn about psychological disorders, PTSD, anxiety, for example, and we know that animals oftentimes in captivity are just, you know, running on empty because they're so stressed. So my take is we need to treat animals much better than we do, and we've got all the science in the world to do it. And I think one of the most egregious oversights is that in the United States Federal Animal Welfare Act, it's right out of the act. It says that they have redefined the word animal to exclude mice of the genus moose and rats of the genus rattus and birds and fish. No one's making that up. So, you know, we know they're animals. We also know that rats and mice and chickens, for example, display empathy. So we have had these data for quite a long time, and they have not been incorporated into any federal legislation. So I always tell people, you know, we're not just putting stories out there. The hard science demands that we incorporate what we know into regulations on how animals are treated and that we can do much better than we are now.
Stan Kuchai.
I have to agree with what everybody has said so far. I do want to go back to one thing that Mark said earlier about intelligence. I have to agree. I think using that word gets us in a little bit of trouble. So when I get asked, how smart are dolphins, my typical response is that that's just not a good question. The better question is, how are dolphins smart? that's sort of what we need to be looking at. We look at, you know, other animals' behaviors, as Mark said earlier, instead of trying to equate them to humans, just try to define them on their own terms. Now, in terms of what we're learning, I think in addition to helping us learn hopefully a little bit about ourselves, one thing that we could do is we need to learn not just how to conserve animals in the wild, and we're a long way from knowing how to do that. If you just look at the evidence for coming extinctions, one thing that we're not doing a good job at, and we could do a much better job at, is making animals in captivity's lives as good as they can be. And I know that that's very controversial, but if we're going to have animals in captivity, and regardless of species, we're obligated to do what we can, knowing what we know about the species, for them to be, I know Mark doesn't like this, doesn't think this word is too wishy-washy, but to ensure that they have the best lives that they can, that their welfare is being taken care of. And I agree with Mark. I don't think we're doing that.
Mark Beckoff, I really like what Stan said about how are animals smart, because I study dogs, among other animals. People will say, are cats smarter than dogs? And I always
right.
will say, well, that's just not a really biologically meaningful question, that animals do what they need to do to be card-carrying members of their species. There's lots of things that mice can do that chimpanzees can't do. When a chimpanzee does something that a mouse or a bird can't do, people will say, oh, look how smart that chimpanzee is. But when these New Caledonian crows, you know, make and use more sophisticated tools than chimpanzees, no one says the birds are smarter. Stan hit it right on the head, because if you say, how are animals smart, you can cash that out, you know, into an argument about adaptation. That's great.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mark Beckoff, Barbara Natterson-Horowitz, and Stan Kujai. So appreciate your research and your thoughts and your willingness to share it with us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Barbara Natterson-Horowitz is a cardiologist, the director of imaging at the UCLA Cardiac Arrhythmia Center, and a cardiac consultant for the Los Angeles Zoo. She's co-author of Zoobiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. Mark Beckoff is professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and his books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and co-author of Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Stan Kujai is director of the Marine Mammal Behavior and Cognition Laboratory at the University of Southern Mississippi. He's co-author of The Emotions of Animals and Humans, Comparative Perspectives. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. An extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Cuauhtemoc Aileman, who produced this show each week, and to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.